welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell, ESPN. We are here on Monday. It's December 10th, 2018, and we have week 14 of the NFL season basically in the books. And I wanted to bring on a couple new guests today. We're going to get to Bill Connolly of SB Nation a little later, but joining us first, someone I wanted to bring on in the hopes that we were going to have we're going to have a bit of an offensive juggernaut last night between the Rams and the Bears. And, well, that did not happen. As you may have noticed, it was quite a defensive struggle between the Rams and the Bears last night. But I still think a really fascinating game and a really fascinating pair of offenses to talk about. And joining me to do that is someone who, of course, played in the Rams offense in the 2017 preseason. Someone who is very familiar with the Bears offense as well. It is our pal Dan Orlovsky here at ESPN. Dan, how are you?
I'm doing great, Bill. How are you, bud?
I am good, and I am excited to talk to you about these games. Like I said, I wish it had been perhaps a little more exciting, a little more offense to talk about. But in terms of what you saw last night, I mean, in terms of the Bears really beating up the Rams, really dominating that offense, were you surprised? How surprised were you? Was it a bad matchup for the Rams you could sense before the game even started?
Well, I took the Bears going into the game. Mm-hmm. I didn't necessarily view it as this bad matchup. I've played against Vic Fangio a few times, and as a defensive coordinator, it's almost like you hear all the time when it comes to teams or athletes that they play up to or down to the level of their competition. It seems like every time Fangio, at least through the past couple of years, is going against a big-time offense, his level goes up. Like, he gets into the very detailed parts of their game plan. Mm-hmm. I just had a really good idea. There are a good feeling that the Bears defense was going to play really good. I understood that the weather wasn't going to be good. And like you look at it for the Rams, I'm not totally pinning it on the weather, but they're starting quarterbacks from California. Mm-hmm. Their best receivers from California and played at USC. Their starting tailback is from the South and went to Georgia and straight from there went to be drafted by the Rams. And weather certainly played its part.
Do you place a lot of stock in that? I know there's certainly that maybe perception that, you have certain players or certain players with certain backgrounds, whether they played in college, in California, played in high school in California, grew up in California, that if they go to play elsewhere in cold weather, they're going to struggle, and that teams in those areas, a team like Buffalo or Green Bay, should go after a quarterback who, has big hands, who has experience playing cold weather. Is that really as impactful as maybe, we think of it on the media side, or is it actually meaningful and something that teams should actually think about in terms of, sort of planning the bigger picture for their quarterback situations?
It's certainly a variable that you have to pay attention to. I mean, the reality is that the weather has an impact on your performance. And certainly if you were going to go do something for 10 years in a controlled environment for the most part, which is in some ways how weather affects you, your body and just everything that you do is going to be so much more in tune to doing it in that environment. And now if you switch it and go, hey, you haven't done this in 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 months. I mean, the Rams had not played in that kind of weather environment in probably a year. And so then you get asked to go do it. It affects you. It affects how you travel. It affects how you go about your business during that day, it affects your warm up, what you put in your body, how you handle sweat, hydration. It affects all those things. So I don't necessarily put a ton of weight in it, but like I said, it's a variable that has an impact on your performance.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. And of course, you played in this game, like I mentioned, in the 2017 preseason with the Rams. It was certainly, it seems like, by the numbers, their worst game under Sean McVay. So when you were watching that game, I mean, was there an adjustment you were expecting the Rams to make and they never did? Or was it just that, the Chicago pass rush was so strong that the Rams didn't really have an adjustment they could have made?
Well, I have been saying this for about 2 years. I played in this offense really from 2009 to 2011, and that was with Gary Kubiak in Houston. And so I have a deep background in the offense. And then Sean McVay, like you had mentioned, I was with them in camp last year, and he's kind of modernized it a little bit with the ability to play with speed, some of the one-word ways to get the plays, and then the pre-snap motions. And so one of the things that I just felt or learned through my time with the Rams was these offenses that run this kind of scheme so well, they mm-hmm. get a defense, they beat you during the week. And what I mean by that is you hear defensive coaches always talk and say, we've got to stop the run, we've got to stop the run, we've got to stop the run. Well, the Rams offense is founded upon the play-action game. Mm-hmm. And so you have a defense and their coaches are yelling at you all week, we got to stop the run. Well, the Rams have, for the past couple years, used that to their advantage. And even though they haven't been able to run the ball that well mm-hmm. in some games, teams are so committed to stopping the run, they flow so quickly to the play-action, and that's what's created some of these chunk plays for the Rams offense. Whether they mm-hmm. were running the ball well or not, the illusion of it made the defense go after them. And what I started to see, it was last week against the Lions and then last night against the Bears, where the Bears did not sell out to stop the run. Mm-hmm. They did not flow and sprint to stop the run just to say, hey, we stopped the run, to give open these, you know, to create all these play action passes. And mm-hmm. so you had a team that Fangio started to mix some of their personnel up. They played with three heavy defensive linemen to stop the run. Mm-hmm. And then their outside linebackers were great when it came to just like pausing in the run game. And so they took away the quick pass game. They didn't sell out to go after the run. That's what forced the play action not to be as effective. And Goff, number one, was taken away a lot in the play action game because you didn't get the full sellout. And then this, mm-hmm. one of the things that I really saw interesting, and I watched it again this morning, was the Rams get into this bunch set a lot, three mm-hmm. receivers to one side. And that's a big part of the play action game when it comes to formation-wise. The Bears blitz that bunch formation. Not a lot of times you blitz away from it because you think, oh, it's the shorter edge mm-hmm. and I'll get home. But they blew up the bunch a lot in the play action, and that forced Goff to move or throw the ball away. So a lot of it was schematically what the Bears did more than what the Rams were unable to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, it was a really impressive performance from Chicago. Do you think, you know, you mentioned the Lions game, of course the Bears were dominant. Do you think teams are going to see this and say, hey, if we did not have an idea about stopping the Rams before, maybe we have a way to sort of focus our game plan during the week? Or do you think this was just, you know, sort of the function of this is a really good defense and they were able to sort of get away with stuff and play in a way that other defenses might not be able to over the remainder of the season?
Yeah, it's probably going to be a little bit combination of both. I mean, sure. As you know, it's a copycat league. So there's going to be coordinators who look at this tape and say, okay, maybe I'll play with more big body defensive linemen to commit to stopping the run just with those four guys. And then my linebackers and my secondary guys, they don't have to flow so hard after the run. Now you have to have the people to be able to do that. It's not just as easy as, okay, we're just going to play that way. Mm-hmm. So you're certainly going to get teams to try it. Whether they can execute it or not will be the biggest question. You know, it's fascinating because if you watch it, they started taking Floyd and putting him inside a little bit as well. Mm-hmm. And so you got Hicks on the field together with Floyd, together with Mack, together with Lynch. There's not a lot of teams in the NFL that have that, those four guys that could be up front. And then you got Eddie Goldman in there as well. Like, they don't have that many bodies, that many people mm-hmm. that can dominate. And so you're going to get teams to try and copycat that recipe. For me, it really is the biggest thing is trying to get your defense not to be so consumed with stopping the run. I'm telling mm-hmm. you, it's the illusion of it, and that's what creates these massive chunks is you don't even have to be running the ball so well, but you're so committed to stopping the run, it's like play action's the easy thing for these offenses.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like it's in their head before the game even starts. Now,
exactly.
Look at their schedule next week. They're playing the Philadelphia Eagles, who we know they're a struggling football team, but if there's one strength to that team, it's the guys they have up front. They have a lot of really talented, impactful players along their defensive line. So if you're Sean McVay and you're looking at what's happened over the past couple of weeks and you think about what you're going to do against the Eagles at home on Sunday, I mean, you know, do you change your game plan at all? Do you maybe rely a little more on the run and sort of remind teams, hey, we can do this and we're going to be able to run the ball on you? Or do you sort of just double down and sort of hope that, you know, your play action game is going to be more effective next week?
No, I think you got to get back to kind of the roots of who you are. Jared Goff, who I think is a fantastic quarterback, is mm-hmm. absolutely best in two aspects. the play action game and the quick game. And so when you're looking at it and going, where do we stand quick game wise? Where do we stand when it comes to just the, you know, what we call, I guess, to the normal everyday person is like the dink and dunk parts of our offense. Mm-hmm. They kind of missed that right now with Cooper Kupp being out, because Cooper Kupp was the, you know, every great baseball pitcher has that first pitch he can throw for a strike to get ahead in the count. That's what Cooper Kupp was to Jared Goff, that I know I can get a completion to Cooper. I know he's going to be fantastic, you know, yards after the catch. Well, they don't have that right now, and they're kind of struggling to replace that. And so you look at the play-action game, okay, how do we get that back? You know, again, this isn't doomsday, but how can we make sure that this is who we want to be? Mm-hmm. You got to get back to running the football efficiently and effectively. And they've done that for the great majority of the year, but the past 2 weeks they haven't. And so if you want to help the play-action game, if you want those defensive coaches being so consumed with the run, mm-hmm. then you've got to get back to running it better.
Now, maybe this is just too simplistic of me, but I look at the Rams and, you know, they've been incredibly healthy this year on offense. Cooper Kupp is hurt, of course. They lost John Sullivan for a few snaps last night, but this is a team that not only has been very healthy, but, you know, when they're able to do what they want to do, they're going to stay in the same personnel just about every single snap. It's going to be three wide receivers, one running back, one tight end, and they're going to basically play the same 10 guys and then rotate the tight end here and there, usually about 60-40 split between Higbee and Everett. So in terms of the Rams' personnel decisions, obviously, you know, they want to make things look similar. They want to make things look about they want to make their run plays and their play action plays look exactly the same, which goes back to, of course, you know, the Kubiak offense you mentioned. In terms of what they are doing on offense, though, do you think they maybe need to mix up their personnel a little bit more without Cooper Kupp available? Or is it just that, you know, this is built upon that 11 personnel and they have to stick with that no matter what they do?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is dependent on the opponent that week and who they're playing. Mm-hmm. And if you feel better with a guy like Josh Reynolds, who would be their third receiver, if you feel better with him on the field than you would a Gerald Everett or a Higbee, who would be one of those second tight ends. Mm-hmm. I love the Rams offense. And the greatness of it is that everything does look the same, that you as a defense are often on your heels because you don't know what's coming. They keep you off balance. And so I believe that they need, in my opinion, that they got to continue to stay with who they are. Stay with that personnel. Now, maybe you diversify it and you do everything that you want to do out of 12, if that's where you feel like, you know, when I say 12, one back, two tight ends, if you feel like that's your best 11, then you adjust and switch your offense off of that. But if you trust in Josh Reynolds, who's had some nice moments, mm-hmm. you stay in your 11 personnel. But that, for me, it'll be something I want to really see over the next month. Who becomes the Cooper Kupp replacement? Who becomes that? Because you lost Cooper Kupp. You lost your backup running back in Malcolm Brown. So some of the pieces that you had that were complementary aren't there. Who's going to replace that production? Is it going to be Gerald Everett? Because that the great thing, or another one of the great things about the Rams offense is it's so efficient. And it's so efficient. And they're lacking, or at least the 2 weeks, they've been lacking that first down efficiency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they put Jared Goff in great situations, and then he's able to deliver. All right, Dan, well, let's get to the other side of this quarterback situation in a moment. But first, wanted to talk about our friends at SeatGeek. And I used SeatGeek just last week. I went to Los Angeles, wanted to go check out the Los Angeles Lakers. They played the San Antonio Spurs. I was a little worried. The Lakers came out for shoot-around. LeBron James was not there, and I was worried I had purchased tickets to a Lakers game that LeBron James was not playing in. But in fact, he did play and was quite effective. It was a fun game, and I got great seats because I used our pals at SeatGeek. Because SeatGeek is going around the web, they are using their deal score technology to rate the tickets they are seeing and then getting them to you reliably and affordably. So you know you're getting a good deal. You know you're getting reliable tickets. I would have been really bummed if I had gone all the way to LA and purchased fake tickets and not been able to get into the Staples Center for this game. And in fact, that was not the case. I had great tickets, had a great time, and that was due to our pals at SeatGeek. And I've used SeatGeek many times, so I can't get $10 off my first SeatGeek purchase, but you, on the other hand, if you have not used SeatGeek, you can. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter in promo code Barnwell when you make your purchase today. That's promo code Barnwell for $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. SeatGeek, life's an event. We have the tickets. Now back to the show. On the flip side of this game, though, another quarterback is put in good situations quite frequently is Mitchell Trubisky, who, I mean, he did win yesterday. You end up getting the W, but certainly not his best performance. Threw three interceptions, averaged under 4 yards per attempt. Just in terms of starting with the mechanics, I mean, he threw three interceptions. One of them was, seems like he just made the wrong decision with the football. The other two were open receivers he missed high. Of course, coming back from a shoulder injury, just in terms of how he looked physically to you, did he look like someone who was struggling with his mechanics? I mean, do you think he was missing because that shoulder's not 100%, or was it just, you know, he missed some throws that were open because that's what happens to quarterbacks sometimes?
Yeah, so when I watched the game live, I was like, gosh, Trubisky looks brutal. And then I rewatched the game, and I kind of had the, all right, he wasn't as bad as I thought he was. Mm-hmm. You know, those two picks, the first pick that sails over Allen Robinson's head, it's second and 15. The Rams drop down into like a three buzz coverage, so cover three, and they've got their four underneath defenders, and they try to really displace, you know, stretch the field horizontally. And it just seemed like Trubisky was trying to make up for the week's miss in that one throw. Like, he was trying to make the hero throw in that moment because he's got two short 7-yard completions on either side of the field on a, like, little hitch routes that are going to be free access, where he's taken those time and time and time again throughout this season since he started. And then you watched the throw yesterday on the pick, and it was just like, wait, what, we haven't seen that out of you since last year, Trubisky. So that was more of like a, okay, I'm trying to be a, you know, make up for the lost time. It's a primetime game. And the one on the crossing seam route to Burton, it just sailed. There was nothing there mechanically. It just, he just missed the throw, which happens sometimes. And I know people like to harp on Trubisky's accuracy, but there's also a lot of throws that are part of that game that are very accurate. So I wasn't as concerned rewatching the game as I was when I watched it live with his performance.
I mean, that's good. You know, it's better to have, you know, to make a bad decision, I think, in some cases, when you think about his future, than you think about him being injured. I mean, obviously, you don't want him to throw the interceptions and make those decisions, but at least you want him to be healthy. I mean, and in terms of his growth this year, I'm someone who's, I've been skeptical of that accuracy. You do notice that, but, you know, I think it is fair to say this is a guy who, he can look great for stretches of the game. I mean, they're, you know, when he's taking those easy throws is the wrong word, but, you know, he's taking those throws that are open. He has great velocity. Those throws are in stride a good chunk of the time, and they were able to really, you know, hit the Rams on the edge and sort of make plays. But, what have you seen from him in terms of his growth from a year ago, and how difficult is it to separate that from just the change in offensive scheme and how, you know, how creative Matt Nagy is in terms of putting Trubisky in great situations?
Yeah, like last year for me was a burned year. I do nothing to judge that year. I didn't do it in 2016 with Jared Goff because the offense was archaic. The people that he was throwing to and playing with weren't serviceable. So it's an unrealistic gauging of a player. And then you get him to this year, much better personnel around him, obviously, and then certainly scheme-wise is significantly more advanced. And so when you look at, okay, you got him with good coaching and good players, and he's performed really well. Early on, the big thing for me with him was it seemed like he was allowing 2017 to affect 2018, where, you know, Matt Nagy has done such a remarkable job of giving him information at the line of scrimmage, whether they're flexing out Cohen or Burton and telling him it's man or zone. And there were moments where you seemed like Trubisky did not trust that information. It was almost like, you know, we tried to do this last year and it didn't work out, so I'm not gonna trust it this year. And then there were times where you can see he wouldn't trust the people around him player wise. And it would almost look like last year where he would be like, no, the guys with me aren't good. I'm not gonna trust that receiver in a one-on-one situation because I couldn't last year. And, you know, really since about the third or fourth game of the year, all the way up until he had gotten hurt, it stood out that he was really progressing with that, really progressing with trusting Matt Nagy and his calls, trusting what Nagy's telling him at the line of scrimmage, trusting those guys in the one-on-one situation. And so certainly a lot of growth. Here's the thing for me when it comes to quarterbacks and seeing if they can go from, all right, there's promise to playing pretty good to, all right, we think we found our franchise guy to, uh-oh, we've got something special for the next decade. I always say great quarterback play, and I learned this from Peyton Manning. Great quarterback play is boring in a good way, where I don't really need to see Tom Brady play, Drew Brees play, Aaron Rodgers play, Peyton Manning play, Matt Ryan. I don't need to see those guys play. I know what their box score is going to look like. I know it's going to look 65-ish percent, probably around 300 yards, two or three touchdowns, maybe a pick every other game. Like, it's just this boring, monotonous, obsessed with the efficiency play. And so that's the thing with Trubisky is, will he get to that level? Can he get to that level? You mentioned, Bill, the consistency. Can he get to that consistent level of taking what we know as easy completions, free completions, smart completions? Will he do that at a boring rate?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly interesting. You know, he's had some great games against some pretty mediocre defenses. It's fair to say the Bucs were not a great defense by any means. The Lions, when he had that big game, was missing. They're missing Darius Slay, Ziggy Ansah, I think only played a handful of snaps in that game. But, I mean, we know the talent's there. I mean, but this is a guy at the end of the day who he played 1 year in college. This is about 20, 25 games into his NFL career. I mean, you know, he's still very inexperienced. So it's still way too early to have any real insight into him, I think, from my perspective, in terms of just figuring out what he's going to be. It's going to take time. He has to get more reps. In terms of his, we talked about his passing ability, but of course he adds a ton of value to this offense as a runner. It seems like every third down where they have nobody open, especially early in games, he manages to find a crease and ends up getting a first down. In terms of, from the defensive perspective, in terms of trying to defend against Trubisky on third downs, what do you think the optimal solution is? Because maybe you want to play man against some of these coverages, but then, or against some of these offenses, but then if you play man and Trubisky escapes the pocket, you're in trouble. So what do you think, if you're a DC, what do you think you do to try and keep Trubisky in the pocket on third downs?
Yeah, you know, and I'm not putting him on this level, but a lot of times, at least this year when I've watched him play, he has reminded me of a young Russell Wilson, where made pretty sound decisions when it came to the passing game and excellent decisions when it came to that run game, where four times a game, you felt like you were in a great call as a DC and your guys executed it, and then he made a play with his feet. You know, if you're a defensive coordinator, it's so hard to play man defense right now because you want to. Main reason you want to is the RPO game, the run-pass option game, to make sure guys aren't staring in the backfield. But at the same time, that's why teams like the Bears are doing so well and the Rams are doing so well, is because you have to have four or five options that can play man coverage really well, because these teams have four or five options that they can get the ball to. And then when they don't, like you talked about, you've allocated so many people with their eyes away from the quarterback that if one person misses, there's no one left for a guy like Trubisky. So as a defensive coordinator on third downs, well, first of all, as everybody knows, it's tied to first and second down. Like, you got to be really good on first and second down. You don't want to be against the Bears in third and three, third and four, third and five, because your chances of conversion naturally aren't going to be as good. But then when the weapons and the feet of Trubisky come into play, it's even harder. I got to think that you want to, I don't understand why teams haven't done this more, is I get more athletes on the football field. Like, I wouldn't play with, unless you've got elite pass rushers, I don't think it's necessarily a great option to keep through two defensive tackles on the field on third and five, third and six against a team like that. Like, no defensive tackle is going to catch him, or very few are going to catch him. So why not bring a more athletic defensive end or an outside linebacker or a linebacker in and put him as one of your four down rush guys? I understand it, you know, weakens you up against the run, but you're also daring the offense to call a run in that situation. I just think you got to have more athletes on the field in those third down situations.
Do you think that's where the game is sort of heading as a whole? I mean, do you think that it's going to come down to a situation where we're going to have, you know, five defensive backs already is the sort of base defense at this point relative to what we saw 20 years ago. But I mean, could it be a thing where you have, you know, three defensive linemen on the field for the vast majority of plays because you want to encourage teams to run an average 4 yards a carry as opposed to, you know, 7.5 yards per pass play?
Yeah, you're going to get more. We're defensively, we've got to trend, coordinators, organizations have to trend to finding guys that are multiple with their positions. And we talk about that a lot when it comes to offensive football, that, you know, a perfect example is the Bears with a guy like Trey Burton. Is he a tight end? Sure. Is he a wide receiver? Sure. Is he a back? Sure. You know, and so we – defense is going to get at to get to the point where, you know, is that guy a linebacker? Sure. Is he a defensive end? Sure. Could he play DB? Yeah. So that'll be the thing that I want to see organizations start to do, is like really find these guys that are diversified, dynamic, and multiple in their positions.
Yeah, I think absolutely. And we're seeing more players like that come into the league now on the defensive side of the ball. But Dan, it's a pleasure to have you on. I wish we had a more exciting offensive game to discuss, but it was really insightful to get this stuff. Where can people check out more of the work you're doing for ESPN?
Yeah, I'm on Get Up on Monday mornings and call a bunch of college football games. I'll probably be doing some NFL studio live and primetime stuff as the college football season gets down. And then I'm on Twitter at Dan Orlovsky 7, which is where I do a lot of stuff and try to get a lot of interaction, education with fans.
Recommended follow. Dan, thank you so much. We're going to come back with more Bill Barnwell Show here in a moment. All right, back here on the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm still Bill Barnwell of ESPN. It's still December 10th, 2018. But we have a new guest, not just new to this episode, but new to the show in general. Someone I've known for a long time. Worked together at Football Outsiders years and years ago. He is the foremost, I would say, quantitative analysis when it comes to the sport of college football. And recently, much to my dismay in terms of competition, has dipped his toes into the water of NFL analysis as well. It's my pal, Bill Connolly from SB Nation. Bill, how are you?
I'm good. I'm not quite sure the competition level is all that stiff, but I'll give it a shot.
I think you're doing just fine. You write more than anyone on the planet. So I don't know how you found extra time to write about the NFL in addition to college football as well.
Well, I try to set it up that, you know, whether we can debate quality or not, nobody can deny the quantity. And that's worked out pretty well for me so far. But yeah, just shifted a couple things, wrote maybe a hair less about college this past year. And really just try to immerse myself. It's really funny how big we make the difference between college and pro football and how mm-hmm. little the difference actually is. I realize I picked a good time to do the both of them together, because they do kind of look more similar this year than most, but they've never looked all that dissimilar, no matter what we say.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to ask you about. So let's start there. In terms of course, this NFL season, obviously scoring is up in the NFL. And after the Rams-Chiefs game a couple Monday nights ago, there was a lot of concern, maybe not a lot of concern, but at least some concern. The NFL was turning into the Big 12. There was just going to be – every game was going to be Rams-Chiefs over and over again. And, of course, you're someone who, you know, you went to a school in Missouri that was in the Big 12 at one point, and you cover college football closely. So do you think that is a fair comparison to make in terms of what we saw in that game, what we've seen from the NFL over the course of the season to the Big 12? And should that be concerning to NFL fans?
Well, I mean, if you've always really enjoyed the way the NFL game looks, then it is a change, and it should be a concern, I guess. But here's mm-hmm. the reminder that Buffalo and Arizona are still NFL teams. It's kind of, you know, just like, you know, Kansas was always in the Big 12 too. The best offenses are getting better. It seems like the spread between good and bad is larger than ever before. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean every offense is suddenly awesome. There's still plenty of really, really bad offenses out there, and it was just two of the three or four best, I guess, playing mm-hmm. against each other. And then, you know, you added 21 more points in defensive touchdowns as well. So it was kind of a perfect storm, I think.
Yeah, I think certainly. In that game, I mean, there were defensive stops. And the Rams did come up with a couple of defensive stops late in that game to end up deciding the game, actually. I mean, do you think that's a fair criticism of the Big 12 in general, that it's just only offense and there's no defensive play at all?
Well, I think you certainly have to redefine what you consider good defensive play. Mm-hmm. And that goes for college football as a whole, but especially the Big 12, where there is a little more, there's a heavier lean on the offensive side of the ball as a rule. Mm-hmm. But it really does. Like I spoke with college football coaches through the years, and every single defensive coach said it took him like 5 years to just accept that, you know, whereas 25 years ago, you know, he would hope that his defense could hold the team under, you know, four and a half yards per play. And mm-hmm. that is not an option anymore. 5.5 yards per play is pretty good. And so it just kind of took a little bit of kind of readjusting their expectations. But within that, you know, once you've made that adjustment, there's still a lot of good defense to be played. Mm-hmm. And we saw that. Well, we saw that with the Chiefs Ravens yesterday. That was a good example of a really good defensive team landing plenty of shots against Kansas City, but Kansas City still landing plenty of shots back.
Right. I mean, do you think that when you think about the football you like to watch as a fan, what does it look like? Does it look more like Chiefs-Ravens? Does it look more like Chiefs-Rams? I mean, what is football like? What do you think of as your ideal football game?
Well, I really, you know, the Chiefs-Ravens game was a lot of fun because you had a lot of defensive plays being made. And you could say the same thing about Chiefs-Rams as a whole. But, I, you know, there is a limit. I enjoy points. I'm not scared of points and yards. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun. But there is a limit where, you know, if it's just breakdown after breakdown, when you start, you know, yelling at your TV, like, oh, come on. You know, that was a terrible defensive play. Like, that's, you can get too far in that direction. And I know there are some commentators who have already started to go in that direction, on the NFL side. But, you know, as a whole, if it's just offenses making a bunch of plays because they're really good, I don't mind points and yards. And it's certainly more fun to watch an up and down game than, you know, three plays, punt, commercial break, three plays, punt, commercial break.
Is there that same sort of nostalgia in college football? Like, do you have significant portions of fan bases that are just like, man, all these points are dumb. We need to go back to, you know, like the, you know, great defenses from the 80s and 90s. Like, is that as prevalent, you think, at the college level as it is, as it seems to be, at least to some extent, at the NFL level?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the timeline's a little different. So this really is like, you know, 15 years ago, SEC, you know, the SEC, you know, people saying the defense wins championships and all that. You know, you can certainly find that. And I think it's basically, you know, what was the best version of your team? That's what I envision all of college football or all of football. That's what it should be like. It should be like my favorite team that I ever watched to play. And one of the things the spread did for at least a little while was make things a little more democratic. So, you know, the Missouris and the Kansases in 2007 and the Texas Techs and whatnot, a bunch of new teams figured out how to move the ball and win games in a non-traditional way, and the teams that really enjoyed winning in a traditional way didn't like it very much. So it tends to balance out after a little while, but I do think that there was plenty of the traditionalist view. Just a lot of that's been beaten out at this point, I think.
Yeah, and I think realistically, and I don't know how you feel the same way, but it just seems like this is where football is going. I mean, we saw teams, yep. You know, we saw smaller teams try and invent, you know, different strategies, whether it was, you know, the air raid or the spread, or not invent, but sort of popularize different elements of how to attack teams. And then they did that to try and beat teams who were, you know, had athletic and physical advantages. And then, you know, the bigger teams in college football started to then take those plays as well. And now we're seeing it at the pro level. We're seeing air raid stuff, you know, become more prevalent, at least at the professional level. Is it just sort of the reality of, you know, we're going to see smaller teams, we're going to see teams from smaller schools and at the high school level innovate to try and win games against bigger, stronger teams, and then we're going to see, you know, sort of the smarter, not smarter, but the teams with more resources copy what they did?
Well, I am curious where things go now because, you know, it's always been kind of a give and take, especially at the lower levels of, you know, if this is kind of the baseline, this is how teams normally play football, you know, we can try to get smaller and faster and create some innovations in that way. And then when defenses get stronger and faster smaller and faster, I should say, then you go in the other direction and you get bigger and stronger and you try to push them over. And there's always been that kind of give and take throughout all of, you know, football's history, basically. I don't really know what happens next, though, because it really does. What we've seen in the pros this year has been really enlightening. Pass efficiency has gone up as pass volume has gone up. Mm-hmm. And rush efficiency, as of at least a couple of weeks ago, it had gone up too as the rush volume went down. And so it seems like there's an optimization process here where teams are going to be skewing further and further in that direction until there's some sort of breaking point where, you know, the return starts to go down again. So I don't know what that means exactly. I don't know how far we go before we reach that optimization point. It could change a lot just in terms of how teams, how franchises build teams. That could be really, really interesting to watch over the coming years. And then what happens when it stops working and who lurches in the other direction and finds success?
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned a team that has had some success in years past, not as successful this year. The Green Bay Packers, of course, who fired Mike McCarthy earlier this month. Are you optimistic about McCarthy's chances, not McCarthy, excuse me, the Packers' chances of sort of regaining their form in 2019?
Well, I think they'll have an equal shot of doing well in 2019 as they did in 2018. They were trying this really just this awkward balance, basically. It's kind of a youth movement while at the same time adding some veterans and having win now mode for Aaron Rodgers' last few years or whatever. It was a tough balance, and you can see how it almost worked. They have been pretty unlucky this year. You know, most of their expensive defensive players have gotten hurt. They've had just weird, you know, a bad kicking game cost them here and a fumble cost them here and all these other things. But they haven't, they didn't overinvest. So their cap situation still looks pretty decent. And now they've got more young cover guys than about anybody in the league. They've got, you know, the young receiving core, as long as one of those rookies sticks, you know, Adams is still pretty young too. They seem to have a nice base of a team. It's just, there's always this kind of desperation involved when you've got an aging quarterback. You don't know how much longer you have with him. But there was nothing that happened this year. If they make a good hire, there's nothing that happened this year that says they're doomed. They could easily put together a pretty good team next year. They should have the flexibility to at least give themselves a shot.
In terms of looking at that, their personnel, looking at what they were struggling with, are they a team where you think they should go out and get sort of a hot shot offensive coach to revitalize that offense and really build around Aaron Rodgers? Or is the opposite true, where you think a team in that sort of situation should go after a defensive-minded coach, someone like a Vic Fangio with the Bears, and then sort of trust, okay, well, if we give Aaron Rodgers a competent offensive coordinator, you know, he's going to be able to figure it out and be just fine. Like, how do you think teams should think about these sort of coaching sort of quandaries, I guess I should say?
Well, for the most part with the Packers, I mean, it sounds like everything we've heard is that they're leaning offense, and it makes sense. You know, it's coax whatever you can out of Rodgers. Honestly, Tutton's done a nice job there this year. Their breakdowns have been enormous. They don't give up 15-yard plays. They only give up, you know, 0-yarders or 30-yarders, it seems like. And so those breakdowns, in part because of the iffy pass rush and in part because of all the young guys they've got in the back, it has been a little bit of an all or nothing approach, but a pretty good one though. So if they can, if they keep him, you know, you don't have to give him the head coaching job, I guess, but if they can manage to keep him in place and allow him to carve out his own footprint on the defensive side of the ball, bring in a guy who can just create a few more easy looks a game for Rodgers and, you know, make it, you know, the picks and everything that a lot of the other teams in the league are doing, just a few more easy looks will make a humongous difference for that team. So leaning on the offensive side of the ball seems like the kind of the default approach. It seems like what they're most likely to do, and it's probably the right move.
All right, we'll be back with Bill Connelly in a moment. But first, wanted to talk about Indochino. Guys, I'm someone who I'm hard to shop for, don't always have the most consistent fit, don't always have clothes that I find especially comfortable. And I'm someone who normally I work from home, I get to relax, I don't have to worry too much about having formal clothes, but I do leave the house occasionally. Occasionally I'm on television, they are foolish enough to put me on TV, and I need some clothes that look good. I can't rely purely on my looks. I need some well-fitting and honestly well-looking clothes. And that's why I went to our pals at Indochino, because Indochino is North America's leading made-to-measure menswear company. There are so many ways you can do it. There's a couple different options. The way I did it was this. I visited a stylist at the Indochino showroom. I had them take my measurements personally. If you don't want to do that, if you don't live near a showroom, well, you can measure yourself at home and then shop online at Indochino.com. You choose your fabric inside and out. You choose your design customization. You submit your measurements. You submit your choices. And then Indochino makes the suit of your dreams. They get it professionally tailored and mailed to you in a couple of weeks. You can't beat that. Don't just go to the store and get some suit that you barely like off the rack for an exorbitant price. Get a great suit and get it at an affordable price, because this week my listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for just $359 at Indochino.com when you enter in promo code Barnwell at checkout. It's 50% off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit, and shipping is free. That's Indochino.com, promo code Barnwell for any premium suit for just $359 and free shipping. That's an incredible deal for a premium made-to-measure suit. Indochino.com, promo code Barnwell. Now back to the show. One guy who's come up a bunch, I don't think he's going to leave necessarily. He said, I believe that he doesn't plan on leaving, is Lincoln Riley, the coach of the Oklahoma Sooners, who probably the hottest name on the head coaching market right now. His quarterback, Kyler Murray, just won the Heisman over the weekend. He was drafted in the first round by the Oakland A's, if I'm not mistaken, in baseball. But I mean, after this season, he has suggested he might want to possibly play football as well, and he seems quite good at it. Do you think it's feasible for him to play both sports at a reasonably high level?
I mean, I think the calendar is going to be his biggest enemy in that regard. His skill set, just the raw skills that he has, it's a combination we rarely ever see. He really does have a center fielder's speed. He's got a leadoff hitter center fielder speed. He can, he doesn't necessarily juke you all that much. He changes directions at full speed and he manages to get around you. But he's also got a really, really nice arm. He's got a center fielder's arm as well. So I definitely understand why the A's drafted him. But he's awesome at football. We can debate whether he's big enough. Like, obviously he's a pretty small guy, both in terms of height and stature. I think we've seen this year with Mayfield and, of course, Breeze for like the last 20 years. Like, height is probably an overrated characteristic as a whole. But he's he's shorter than they are. It would take a system where the offensive coach, the offensive coordinator, and head coach, and everybody, they were really flexible in what they designed for him to make sure that they were taking advantage of his skill set because it's unique. He's awesome at both. The problem is just going to be how do you play pro quarterback? It's one thing to be like a Deion Sanders or a Bo Jackson. Neither of them were quarterbacks. Mm-hmm. How do you pull that off? Because that's going to take a lot of work to become a really good pro quarterback if you really want to invest in that. I don't really necessarily see where the time is to also be good at baseball and continue to pursue that.
It just seems like a lot of work. I mean, I just don't see how you could possibly do all those things at a high level. And I mean, you know, leaving out the idea of whether NFL teams are they overcorrect for height and they're too concerned about players being small, because I think that I agree with you. I think that is the case. I think in terms of how they actually think on a week-to-week basis now, even if it's wrong, I have to imagine that he's not going to do well in the combine process, because even though he is a great athlete, even though he was very successful at college, I think there are teams that are going to ding him for that lack of height and basically try and find reasons to fall out of love with him given that lack of size in the sort of combine pre-draft process.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what they do. They're really good at falling out of love with guys for the most part. It really is. I mean, with the combine, like all the ways we judge these guys, it's like they're going from flag football to tackle football or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, can he throw over a line? Can he see over a line? Well, all of his OU linemen are 6'4" or 6'5". Yes. Big 12 linemen Big 12 defensive linemen for all their, it's not the best defensive line league in college football, but it's not because the guys are short. So it's not like this is a thing that he's going to suddenly encounter. He's used to being the shortest guy around, and he still managed to do well enough to win the Heisman Trophy. So obviously it's different at the pro level, but it's not a completely different sport. He would understand, he would learn and kind of grow in his skill set if he pursued it. I still think, in the end, he probably pursues baseball his sudden kind of hesitation here and his struggle to make up a decision, because he had a really good year on the football field and it was a lot of fun and he wants to do it more. And I assume he will move past that, but it'd be really interesting if he did choose to pursue football now.
Let me ask you, is there a draft level at which point you would recommend he does decide to pursue it? I mean, like, if he's a fifth round pick, I think it's pretty obvious he's just going to, go play baseball. And then if it doesn't work out, like Drew Henson or whatnot, he'll come back at, 26 or 27 and give it a second shot. We'll see how it goes. But, if he's a first round pick, do you think he should pursue football if that's what he really feels like he should do?
Yeah, I mean, in the end, this is a following your heart kind of deal. It's, which sport does he like best, I guess. But it does sound like there would be the draft grades for him would be all over the map because of the size thing. Somebody would look at just the skill set that he has to offer and they project him as a first rounder because he was a five-star recruit and he's a Heisman Trophy winner. He's got that level of skill, but he would have some physical limitations to overcome. That makes the whole thing pretty really hard to figure out if you're Kyler Murray, because obviously, I don't think if a team doesn't know for sure that he's going to play football, they're not going to pick him with a first or second round pick. And so they would have to he'd have to commit in advance. I don't think he's going to quite get the clear answers he's looking for.
Do you think he should just come out and say, hey, if I don't get taken in the first, two rounds, I'm going to go play baseball?
Yeah. If it's not a first or second round pick, don't pick me. I guess you could. We know how the evaluation process works, and he'll get dinged for a lack of commitment or whatever. But it is a really, he's just such a unique talent, and it makes for unique questions like this. Like I said, my instinct is that he ends up playing baseball here, but if he hears good things from the scouts, if he decides to go through the combine process, because I would assume around that time he's going to be involved in spring training somewhere or another, if he decides to pursue it to that level, he's going to test out really, really well in some areas, and it might be tempting for a team to maybe throw, if he's still around in the third round or something, just go ahead and pick him just in case, I guess. But I doubt it. I assume in the end the decision is made in March or April, and he's already on his path one way or the other by the time the draft rolls around.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Now, just in terms of the bigger picture, we'll finish up here. You know, in terms of the prototype of what a quarterback should look like or what it should be like, do you think it's any different at the college level now? And I mean, we still have those, you know, the Josh Allen types who come in who are tall and have strong arms and NFL scouts fall in love with them. Not every team does, obviously. He wasn't the first overall pick. Baker Mayfield was, who's a very different sort of quarterback, but there's still teams who really value that. I mean, do you think the prototype has changed at the college level, and do you think it's going to change eventually at the pro level, where someone like a Kyler Murray might be seen as more valuable than he might be seen right now through the same pre-draft process?
Yeah, I think what we've seen at the college level is that, most of the five-star guys, unless you are as athletic as Kyler Murray, most of the five-star guys are still normal quarterback height. I think basically height is still a plus, but a lack of it is less of a minus than it used to be. And I would hope, you know, if the anonymous NFL scouts that always, say negative things about every prospect in the world in January, February, and March, if they really are, you know, up to their jobs, I would hope that if Baker Mayfield goes on to have a lot of success here moving forward, and he's certainly shown hints of it at least, if he goes on to have great success, and if Josh Allen bombs, since he's basically like the best wildcat quarterback in the NFL right now, just don't ask him to throw, I would hope that that's evidence that they would use to kind of change their evaluation process a little bit. I think we've seen that it takes a lot of evidence for people to change their impressions, but I would hope that they are up to doing it, because it becomes pretty clear at that point that, again, if you can find a great talent who's 6'6" and one who's 6 foot, pick the 6'6" guy. That's fine. But if the 6 foot guy knows how to play quarterback, pick him.
It does seem like it would be that simple, that you would just pick the guy who was good at the exact same sport, playing with relatively similar sized people. And maybe you might get it wrong. I mean, not every short guy is great by any means, but it does seem like you have enough examples at this point that maybe you'd opt for the guy who's good at football versus the guy who was okay at football and just happens to be taller. But we will see. There's a mystery that comes with the pre-draft process that we will see with Kyler Murray. Mr. Connolly, it is an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. I'm sure I'll have you back on during the pre-draft process. But in between now and then, where can people check out the many things you produce on the internet?
Well, the Twitter account is probably the go-to there, SBN_BillC. Everything I do, you'll find out through there, but you can find my work at SB Nation. You can find a lot of the stat stuff at footballstudyhall.com. You can find the S&P Plus ranking still at Football Outsiders, actually. They get updated there and at SB Nation each week. So lots of places, but if you follow me on Twitter, you'll hear about each post that goes up.
I can't believe you did not plug your podcast.
Well, that's true. I've never claimed to be good at selling myself. But yes, podcast Ain't Play Nobody with Stephen Godfrey. We are back to recording once a week now after doing three times a week during the season. But yeah, it has picked up in popularity. It's a lot of fun to record, and people seem to like it.
Well, I mean, you know what? I love you as a host. I can't say the same for your podcast partner, but you can't win them all. That's just how it bears down.
Yeah, he really is hard to like, but you know.
Incredibly unlikable Stephen Godfrey and the extremely likable Bill Connolly on Podcast Ain't Played Nobody. Please check that out. And Bill, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks so much to my guest today, ESPN's Dan Orlovsky, SB Nation's Bill Connolly, two first-time guests. Hope you enjoyed it. We're going to come back with more audio here on Thursday. I'll be in studio. Hopefully, my dog Maggie will not be sleeping and / snoring during part of the show on Thursday. But you know what? If I can bring her to ESPN, I'll be excited. But we have more audio coming for you later this week.